privilege of hearing him twice, and I'm looking forward to hearing him again tonight. So y'all help me welcome Tom C. from Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh, I'm Tom Clunch, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. Hey, I'm excited about being here with you. I just feel extra good today. There's something unique about being in a beautiful facility like this and walking out by the river and enjoying the sort of things that you have given me. And I want to thank you for it. You have given me my life, and you have given me something that makes my life worthwhile. Because if it was not for you, Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be alive today. And if I was, I'd be so darn unhappy and miserable that I wouldn't enjoy any quality of life at all. I think that we have something unique. I think that we have something truly beautiful that we can share. And I believe that the essence of the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous is sharing. And I am pleased and proud and that you're allowing me to share with you. And thank you, Winnie. You know. Let me say something before I start to talk. I feel that we have a real seriousness about what we do. You know, we have so much doggone fun. We laugh, and everybody, I've run into 40 good friends, and everybody's laughing and happy, and certainly we're noted. We hear so many people say that when they walked into their first AA meeting, they saw the friendly smiles and the happiness, and we just enjoy laughter and humor and not taking ourselves so seriously and all the things that help us get well. But I also recognize that when you're brand new, and some of you out there may be, certainly I was brand new when I came to you, and when you're real close to the pain, it's not so doggone funny. And if you got out of jail last night, if you wrecked your car yesterday, if you were fired from your job of 15 years last week, if you just got out of the insane asylum, if your husband is still out there drinking, then some of the things that we laugh hysterically about aren't so doggone funny. And I want you to know that we hurt with you, that we understand, that I understand. And even in our laughter and our joviality, that we know that there's a seriousness about the disease called alcoholism. Cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. And that means it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. It always gets worse. And certainly, one of the things that we can share reminded me of a little line. I don't know where I heard it, but it's what I want to focus on tonight. And it goes like this. Joy shared is twice joy. Sorrow shared is half sorrow. You see, when we share our joy like we're doing tonight, it just multiplies. It's just wonderful for all of us. But at the same time, we can share our hurt. We can share our pain. We can share our sorrow, and by spreading it amongst all these strong backs and all these strong spirits, then we ourselves can be strengthened. I hurt a lot. AA has given me so much. It's kept me sober for a number of days at a time now, and it's given me new direction in my life, but I'm not always so doggone well. And sometimes I hurt, and I recognize that. And it says our primary purpose is to stay sober. That's a biggie where it comes to me. And to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And it does not say the drunk alcoholic who still suffers. It says the alcoholic who still suffers. And I have been around long enough, or maybe I'm getting honest enough with myself, to recognize that you can be sober. You can be getting a heck of a lot better a day at a time with this beautiful program. You can be receiving blessings from God as you understand Him big time, and you can still suffer. You can still hurt. And I do right now. And I appreciate you allowing me to share with you. It's important. I want to share like the book says. My sponsor is sitting around over there big time. And I hope I can remember to talk a little bit about big time. Bless his heart. And he taught me the downtown group in Montgomery, Alabama, taught me some fundamental truths. And I hope, by George, if it hair lips the boogerman, you know, I'll run before I take it back. I hope that I can stay true to those simple truths that I believe are the essence of the program that we share. I base my entire program upon a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the rule book, the game plan, the lesson plan. It's not a novel, although there's some real juicy soap operas in the back, but it's not a novel. It is a textbook. And like a textbook, you don't just read it once and discard it, but you study it, and it grows with you. And it becomes a day-by-day plan for dealing with this pain that I talked about. And the book tells me that when I'm standing up here, it almost tells me I can't do what I just was doing, except I was trying to share. It says that I can't preach, and I can't teach, and I can't philosophize, and I can't do lots of things. It tells me I can do one thing. I can share. And then it tells me how I'm supposed to share. I'm supposed to share how it was, what happened, and how it is now. It even goes beyond that, and it tells me what to share. It says, share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And a couple years ago, I got to looking at that. And I began to, because I do, my sponsor, he told me, you study the material, you read the literature, you go to meetings, you do the sort of things that help you stay alive. And I was just blessed enough, or dumb enough, or sick enough to do it. And so I got to looking at sharing experience, strength, and hope. Now, when I share my experience is the sum total of me. I am my experience. So I share myself with you. I'll share Tom Clonch with you, alcoholic, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the happy, and the pain. And then it says I'll share my strength. And that's where I had my first problem with that until I began to do my homework a little bit, because I said to myself, how am I going to share my strength when in fact that is what always almost killed me, my strength? Because you see, I don't have any. The book tells me that what I suffer from is essentially a problem of powerlessness. That's what I don't have. I have a lack of power. I have an inability to control and direct my own life with any guarantee of success. But then, and we didn't read it tonight, but it was right before what we just read out of chapter 5. It says, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. So when I share my strength, when I share my power, I share my God. And my God is very important. My God is a big God. And the only reason I mention that is because if you have the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous that allows you to, in essence, create your own God. You see, it says God as you understood him. That gives you a liberty to, in essence, create your own God. Why create a skinny little God? Why try to put him in a box? Why not do like Bob Shula when he says, dream big dreams? Why not make God just as big as you could possibly believe, and maybe you'd even get a little bit close to how big he really is? So my God is a big God for whom all things are possible. And then it says I'm supposed to share my hope. Boy, I was a hope type of person. Boy, I hope I get out of this trouble. Boy, I hope I can pick up these checks. Boy, I hope this judge is lenient. Boy, I hope this psychiatrist will leave me alone. Boy, I hope these pills will work. You know, hope is kind of a feeble thing in a lot of ways, and because it's trashed so much. You see, true hope is more akin to another word that was the foundation of the program. I like my homework in AA. I like history. Out there on the wall it says 50 years. We have 50 years of experience, strength, and hope, and tradition, and books, and literature, and old-timers like Joe and Big Tom and others that passed down what we can call the oral history. And I know that in the very beginning, this is interesting, when the first couple drunks got together, Bill and Bob, when they were functioning there in Akron in that first group, that when they evolved a little bit out of that Oxford group, you know what they call themselves to begin with? They call themselves the James Club. You know why they call themselves the James Club? Because they based the essence of their recovery from alcoholism on a book called James. a book that features very strongly the line that says, faith without works is dead. Hope without works is hopeless. The type of hope that I want to share with you is faith. May I share my faith with you? Faith is much stronger. Faith is the sure expectations of things to come unseen. The type of faith that allow a person to step out of a boat into a tumultuous sea and stand there on the stormy waters with his eyes focused on the goal, on the target. And of course, the target we have is sobriety, the 12 steps, the sharing, the love of this program. And it was only when Peter took his eyes off the goal, it was only when his face was reduced by seeing the tumultuous waves around him, that he began to sink. And I think the same thing would happen to me. If I take my eyes off of you, if I separate myself from you and find myself out here looking at the negative, looking at the pain, feeling the hurt, if I take my eyes off of big time, then I too will sink. I'll sink into a sea of utter desperation that we know of as alcoholism. Cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. That means it always gets worse and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. Let me share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You know, it's Thursday night and it's supposed to be kickoff speakers, and I ran into so many friends here that I'd just be plumb embarrassed to tell my Baptist preacher's story, so I'm not going to. If you want to hear my Baptist preacher's story and you hadn't already heard it four times, go see Bob, and I'm sure he has it on electronic media or something. But I ran into another one. Now, this wasn't a Baptist preacher, I'm sorry to admit, but it was a situation where a Jewish rabbi and a Catholic priest found themselves together, and they were on Amtrak or something coming into Atlanta, been riding along facing each other for a while, and they finally tried to communicate a little bit. I want to talk to you about communications. And finally, the Catholic father looked over at the rabbi, and he says, Rabbi, when we get into Atlanta, I want you to come home and have dinner with me. It'll really be wonderful. We can fellowship. We're having pork chops. And the rabbi said, well, really, I can't. I'm not allowed pork chops. And the Catholic priest said, oh, I'm so sorry. And they rode along in silence for a while, you know. And then the rabbi said, but Father, since I can't come with you, perhaps you could come over when we get to home and have dinner with me. And it'll be wonderful. And bring your wife. And the priest said, but, you know, we're not allowed that, so I really can't. And the rabbi said, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, much better than pork chops. You know, there's kind of a point to that story, and the point is that from our different perspectives, we can see value in different things. I dealt with something called truth a lot. The program talks about truth. There's a big problem with truth, particularly in someone like me who has the basic inability to be in direct contact with truth. Truth sort of comes in the eyes of the beholder. You see, what is true to me, with all of the distortion that alcoholism caused, what is true to me may not be truth to you. And what we're dealing with here in Alcoholics Anonymous is something even stronger. It's called reality. Reality is what really is. And reality is that the 12-step spiritual program of Alcoholics Anonymous and being involved, immersed totally within it, is a totally effective recovery plan from a hopeless state of mind and body that's called alcoholism. And I got it. I got it real big and real bad. And in Columbus, Georgia, I recognize it maybe more than some other places, because my earliest memory of life was out there at Fort Benning. I was very young when my dad was there and involved in the infantry school. And I was very young. My sister was born out at Fort Benning. But I remember And I began to build those records that still play in my mind. And one of them was my gross inferiority. I could never measure up. And I began to understand that because I could not measure up, I should expect failure. I should always talk about big things and bright futures, but I would always blow it. I inevitably blew it. I looked for reasons and excuses to blow it, you know? And when I was in high school, the first time I blew it big was getting involved with some illegal activities at Fort Benning, including, I think, breaking an entry at the officers' club out there and hauled off by the FBI and the CIA and some things in the very earliest days of my career as an active alcoholic. Because from the very first, alcohol did something different to me than it did to a lot of other people. One of the things the downtown group taught me, by the way, is that you, when you listen to a story, you listen for the similarities, not the differences. So I learned how to do that. I learned how to listen to a lady like Winnie and know when she's sharing from her heart and when she's sharing feelings that I felt those same things. Maybe she's a lady and maybe I'm a redneck from Alabama and there's a lot of differences, but the similarities are the pain of alcoholism. And I hurt from the very beginning. I remember the first time I drank. You know, that's interesting to me. So many AA speakers remember their first drink, and in my case, my first drunk. I don't remember my first peaches. I love chocolate ice cream. Oh, wow, can I get turned on with Haagen-Dazs? But I don't remember my first chocolate ice cream. I got nothing against blondes, but I don't remember my first blonde. But I remember my first drink. I remember it real good. That's interesting. I don't know why. I think why was because that drink did something different to me than it did to other people. It gave me a message. I don't remember the message, but I remember that it gave me a message. I remember drinking almost an entire bottle of Christian Brothers Sherry out of a beautiful imported leaded crystal cut glass decanter, the type that people are supposed to just pour just a little bit out in a ding, one of those little crystal glasses, you know, and sip on it a little bit. And while my parents were out, I just kind of drank up the whole thing. You know, I think maybe I was, that's not social drinking. You know, I remember then the next few times that I drank when I was in the latter grades of high school and maybe in early college, and it included all that mess out at Fort Benning and a whole bunch of stuff that was a great embarrassment to my family. My dad was a career army officer and a good man, a beautiful man, a spiritual person, educated, learned, the type of person that I always wanted to be. And I began to interfere with his life. I understand Al-Anon. I am not an Al-Anon. But when I read chapter 9 in the big book, and it talks about the impact that the alcoholic has on their family members, I know the impact that it had on my dad, and on my mother, and on my sister, and later on family members of my own. Because everywhere I went, I was just a destruction going somewhere to happen. And I got in big problems. I was summarily dismissed from Auburn at age 17 for drunk. In the next year, I was arrested 3 or 4 or 5 times down in New Orleans for drunk. Teeth, hair, blood, eyeballs, blunt instruments, guns, loud noises, malicious destruction, wrecked cars, complicated things. You know, and that wasn't the way I was reared to be. So the earliest pain that I got from a disease called alcoholism, the earliest pain that I got that I remember was I began to violate myself. In another big book that I really like sometime, communicates with me sometime when I let it, in the second half of the 7th chapter of a book a friend of mine named Paul wrote to some folks at Rome called Romans, Paul talks in there about the terrible dilemma of the fact that he always did the things that he didn't want to do and he always didn't do the things that he wanted to do. And that describes my career as an alcoholic so great. Yeah, I had blackouts later on, but the pain wasn't that. The pain was that I consistently violated myself and my own values. Now, alcoholism brought my values down, but I always had some values, and my values had to do with graduating from college and getting a job with a large corporate structure and rising unerringly to the top by sweat of brow and perseverance and diligence and work and seniority and all those Horatio Alger type of attributes that I was supposed to have. I was supposed to get a three-bedroom brick and marry a pretty blonde girl and have a couple pretty blonde kids with blue eyes and a pocket full of credit cards and be a deacon in the Baptist church. Beautiful things. And yet I saw myself going further and further away from it. And I saw myself violating everything that I held dear. I got back into the University of Alabama then at about age 19. And over there I did good. I really learned something when you began to teach me about enablers. Oh, I love enablers. And the sad matter is, I'm going to take up for enablers. Enablers lately have gotten a bad rap. There's some people running around that are involved in things called intervention and constructive confrontation and contrived crisis and whatever all that is. And they're giving enablers a bad rap. Enablers saved my life. Time after time after time, enablers were the people who hauled me off to the hospital. Enablers were the ones who called the rescue squad. Enablers were the ones who hid my guns. Enablers were the ones who enabled me to continue living. They may have enabled me to continue to get sicker and sicker, but it's hard to recover from dead, you know? Enablers kept me from getting big time dead. And I worked on that. Because I have this big thing called self-destructive. That's me. I have heard suicide described as the ultimate in self-criticism. And I have, that's a biggie. And alcohol took me that direction. Now don't get me wrong, when I was drinking, I was having a big time. But it was when I would not be drinking that I would then drop into some sort of massive despondency or depression, even at early ages, because I had such an active conscience. You see, I was brought up in an environment that installed these good Christian virtues in me. Sometimes we laugh about that. I don't laugh about it anymore. I've heard as many speakers as you have that get up behind this podium and say that I was reared in a good Christian family, and everybody snickers and says, well, that's the breeding ground of alcoholics. But I'm going to tell you what I now believe. I now believe when I hear those people say that, they are saying it as a recovering alcoholic standing behind a podium sharing their experience, strength, and hope. I truly believe that early foundation of some sort of spiritual values and truth allows them to build upon it when they get to that point that they come in contact with the spiritual recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the chapter to the agnostic tends to lead me to strengthen my belief in that. It does say, in fact, that you don't have to have any beliefs at all when you come in this program. But it does say, since you were about to die, why not try having a little bit of belief? It does say that you don't have to be involved in any sort of formal religious activity. But it also says that many of us have found that it's a good thing to do. And I read that book. I read all those sort of little entreats in there because, you see, it keeps me alive. It keeps me alive, and I need a lot of keeping alive because I have a very bad case of a disease called alcoholism, and I still got it. Big Tom and the downtown group and all of y'all have helped me stay sober. If I was in Texas, I'd just go ahead and tell you because they required out there since May the 1st, 1971, and for that I am very grateful, but that doesn't mean I'm well. In fact, I recognize that I'm not. And I got over there at University of Alabama and I learned how to build enablers. You build enablers through overachievement. You build enablers through doing very, very good things on the one hand. I mean big time superstar things on the one hand. Because if you do enough good things on the one hand, then when you do your inevitable bad things on the other hand, they kind of just balance out. And that became the pattern of my life until you found me. I went from glory to disaster. I went from outstanding to crisis, time after time, periods in between. At the University of Alabama, I studied hard because that was part of an overachiever. If you make all A's and win honors and you're officer in ROTC and get involved in athletics and get jobs and impress enough people, then when you go out here and get drunk and spend all your money or gamble away your tuition or wreck a car or get in a fight or miss class or whatever you do that I always did, then it tends to offset. And so I made very, very good grades, and I did well over there. And then I share with you the type of bizarre and erratic behavior that always struck me down. You know something? From the time that I was 16 till the time that I was 30, not a single year passed that I was not arrested at least one time. In fact, it was a good year if I was only arrested one time. You know something? Since I was 30 years old till tonight, I hadn't been arrested at all. That's kind of ironic, isn't it? And the only difference is, same crazy sick person. The only difference is, the same flawed vessel. The same child of God who cannot always guarantee his behavior. The only difference is, you have taught me how not to drink one day at a time. And you've taught me a spiritual way of life which helps me try to deal with things that come along one day at a time. That's the only difference. And that's big. That's important. I was at the Birchfield Hotel one night drinking beer. Now, that was not unusual because I was at the Birchfield Hotel every night drinking beer. And I think I probably ordered about six when they came around with last call because that's what we did. And I was drinking on my six, and I had met this wonderful person. I don't know about you, but when I drank, I didn't meet average bears. I met brain surgeons, astronauts, nuclear physicists, and scientists, engineers, owners of major corporate enterprises. I had met this. I think Dr. Silkworth in one of his writings refers to him as a lower companion. I met this lower companion, and we were finishing our last call, and we're going out the door, and he said, no, he didn't say nothing yet. A craving was flung on me for some fried catfish. Now, I'm going to tell you about cravings, and if there are any psychologists out there and you want to talk about obsessive compulsive behavior disorders or anything, I just get cravings flung on me, and I still do. But there was a difference, because when I was drinking, if a craving was flung on me for something, I had no respect for the law of the land, for torts, for property rights, for possession, for nothing. And if I wanted something and you had it, lady, you were in a world of trouble. Nowadays, when I get a craving flung on me, I obey the law. I may get up in the middle of the night and drive all over Montgomery hunting for Barber's Orange Sherbet and Canada Dry Ginger Ale, you know, at 2 in the morning. But I buy it when I find it. I don't just break the window and get it like I used to. But a craving was flung on me for some fried catfish, and Tuscaloosa wasn't such a big town way back in those primitive days, and everything was closed up. And my lower companion, understanding my dilemma, said to me, you know, my uncle is a catfish fisherman down on the Warrior River. And he's always got a deep freeze full of catfish. And we could go over there and we could get that catfish and we could take it back to the dormitory and fry it up in the electric skillets and keep drinking these little pony buds and it'd be wonderful. And I said, let's do it. And we went on over to the uncle's house, and it was dark. And it was quiet. And it was obvious that nobody was home. Now, I welled up from deep within me all of those Dean's List grades. I welled up 4 semesters of almost straight A's and 1 quarter at Auburn and more intellect and cool and that you ever saw, and did the only logical, rational thing. I kicked the door down. And we went on in the house and got the catfish, and as we were coming out the door, my lower companion said, you know, this is my mean uncle. I don't know what your stereotype of a mean catfishing uncle is, but my stereotype wasn't good. So I got out my gun. Now, I always had guns. And if there are any Freudian analytical type psychiatrist out there that graduated at Emory or something And they want to talk about guns being an extension of your male virility and all that kind of business. I don't want to hear it. I just like guns. I like what they do and how they sound. And I think Smith & Wesson made everybody 9 feet tall. But I got my gun out, and using the finest form that I had learned in ROTC, boom, I blew the little gray myopic eyeball out of the television set. I shot a couple pictures off the wall, and then I blew the lock off the door. Because you see, I was thinking that when the FBI and the CIA, when the Tuscaloosa County and City Police, when the Alabama Highway Patrol, the Georgia Troopers, the Canadian Northwest Mounties and the Texas Rangers, when they came to investigate this grand happening, they would think that it was some interstate desperado like Bob Polk that done it, wouldn't they? They wouldn't think it was some fine straight-A student out at the university, would they? When I woke up in jail, I found out that I suffer from impaired judgment. Now, I need to explain impaired judgment to you. Impaired judgment, not when you do stupid things. Not at all. Impaired judgment is when you do stupid things while thinking that you're doing inordinately crafty things. And that I suffer impaired judgment whenever I drank. And I did things that were bizarre and crazy and insane. And I thought that I was doing smart things and clever things. It was really bad. You see, this disease that I have, I came to a conclusion a couple of years ago, Joe, that I was born a half pint low. And I'm serious as I can be. I believe that physiologically I was born a half pint low. And when I took those first drinks and got that half pint in me, I got back to normal. I got back to where I could deal with the pain and the reality of life. Because that half pint filled up a deficit in me. But there was a problem. I always went beyond that half pint, and I went on into this bizarre behavior. And what you have given me that saves my life a day at a time is that you have given me, through your love and through this spiritual program, you have given me something else to fill up that half pint deficit. It's still there. It's called go to meetings. It's called share. It's called 12-step work. It's called putting yourself out and giving to other people. But by doing those things, I can build up a spiritual charge or a spiritual battery within me to the point where I don't have that deficit, to where I can feel normal. And on a really good day, like tonight, I can even feel a little better than normal. I can feel happy, I can feel serene, I can feel at peace, I can feel a closeness and a nearness to my Maker as a spiritual being. The great fear is being completely cut off and alienated from spiritual contact with your Maker. And we all have that need. And AA regave it to me, built my charge back up. I woke up in jail, and I had every attribute at age 19. I had every symptom. I had every sign. I had every type of situation, condition that I had the last time that I drank. I had great guilt. I had shame. I had fear. I had remorse. I had anxiety, that free-floating dark cloud of doom that followed me around. I had that big hole, that big empty hole in my stomach that the cold wind blows through. Y'all close that hole up. Y'all close that hole up. It still pops open every now and then, and I feel those little flickerings of fear down there, and I have learned some little tricks. One of my little tricks is, and it may sound real dumb to some people, and when I share this with folks other than you, they say, isn't that the stupidest thing they ever heard? But you know, when things are really bombarding me, when I'm hurting real bad, I try to conjure up the image in my mind of the times that I was in those little rooms that didn't have any doorknob on my side of the door. And I look over on my door and there's a doorknob, and I know I can get up and open it and walk out if I need to, wherever I am. In a boss's office, in an IRA audit, wherever I am, there's a door over there with a knob on my side of the door. And when I get that little simple truth, it'll get me over those little sinking spells. And it also tells me Boy, you need a meeting tonight. And so I rush down and let pat Big Tom on the head or something and feel the joy that we share. I think the ABCs that we may not concentrate on, we're always concentrating on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12s. But there's some ABCs in that fifth chapter that are big time, strong, powerful message. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, and I couldn't. And B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Friends, I got news for you. Human power includes AA members. It includes sponsors. It certainly includes all kind of helping professionals. Human power could not relieve my alcoholism. But see, God could and would, if He were sought. You taught me that. And it is true. It is as true as it can possibly be. If you have any question in your mind as to whether the AA program can work for you, just look around. Look around. It's beautiful. I was very inquisitive when I came in the program. I wanted to recover if I had enough brains to want to recover. I've got brain damage, and people laugh when I say that, but I really do. And I've learned to compensate from some of it, but I really do. And when I came in the program, I cannot remember the first 6 months in the program. The first 6 months dry are much blanker to me than the last 6 months drinking. I just really can't remember when I met my sponsor. I was sharing at dinner tonight that I remember one AA meeting in that whole time. I got real active in institutional work. I was drafted into institutional work. My sponsor said, "You want to stay sober? Come to prison." And boy, prison was the last place I wanted to go. And we'd go up to Draper, and they'd start slamming the doors, clang, clang, and we'd get back in there. And I remember my first AA meeting at Draper Prison. And a real bizarre AA friend of ours sharing his story. And it's out there, and we're in the rain and under little tin sheds, and we get in there. If you want something that will really build your battery, remember that stuff I was talking about called faith? Trust me, institutional work will charge your battery. It's not fun. It doesn't have the immediate rewards and the laughter. And when you share with an institutional group, you see they're all in great pain. And they don't laugh at your funny stories. And they don't understand the message sometime. But there is great spiritual growth in dealing with the institutional groups, both in the hospitals and in the state mental institutions and in the corrective institutions. And I got great growth with Big Tom in there. But brain damage blanked me out. I can't remember those times. So I had to just do what you told me to do. And I'd go back to the big book, and I'd pick up the literature. And then because I was inquisitive, I read things and I asked questions. You know, I think that's the way we grow in this program. I did a little survey when I was in the program about 10 years. Just my own little survey. I'd walk up and ask people like Winnie and Big Tom and Joe and some of my other friends that have been around a number of years. In fact, I went around asking people at that time that had 15 or 20 or 25 years, and I'd say to them just casually, you know, I wasn't doing any George Gallup deal. I'd just say, would you share something with me? Oh, they'd love to. Let me tell you the biggest one I'm shared with me. I ran into, this is a little departure, but it's a biggie. I ran into this old gray-bearded, moss-backed AA member that had been sober since 3 days before the flood and out in Arkansas. And that rascal shared with me how to get 30 years continuous sobriety. Would you like to know how to stay sober 30 continuous years? You'd like to? Don't drink and don't die. And you heard that, didn't you, Big Tom? Don't drink and don't die. Anyway, I started asking these folks. I said, tell me what you did when you first came in the program. See, I wasn't so interested in as much in what they were doing now as what they did when they were where I was, because I am where I am, see? And so I said, what did you do your first years in the program? Every one of them. Try it yourself. You find somebody that's a winner. You find somebody that's been around 15 years or more, and you say, what did you do in your first 6 months or year in the program? I'll bet you every one of them says, First, they went to almost every meeting they could get to. Now, back in those days, there wasn't meetings everywhere like they are now, and people routinely drove 40 and 50 miles to go to a meeting. But they went to meetings every time that they could go. They got a sponsor, or a sponsor got them, one or the other. And if you don't have a sponsor, you have lost half of the power of this program. But they got a sponsor. They read the book. There was not all the literature. There wasn't Dr. Bob and the good old timers and AA comes of age and all the new kind of literature we have, which is so strong. But they read what they had, and they did 12-step work. They shared. They helped other people. Go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the literature, and carry the message, even if you're just carrying, you know, along with somebody else. Every old-timer that I've ever run into did that in their first 6 months of the year and laid the foundation for where they are now, one day at a time. And so I set out trying to do that, you see, because I was very, very sick. Well, I was sharing with you waking up in that jail at the University of Alabama and having the same feelings that I could have tonight if I would make the mistake to take a drink, and having some of the same feelings that I have tonight if I make the mistake of not maintaining my spiritual battery charge. You see, I believe, I have never seen this proven, but I believe that sober is the abnormal state for an alcoholic to be in. I believe that drunk is the normal state for an alcoholic. I believe sober is an abnormal state that is maintained one day at a time, contingent upon the daily maintenance of a spiritual recovery program. So that I am sharing with you now from an abnormal state. And if I don't work the program, then I will revert back to what my normal state is. And you can see that in all of nature. See those pretty gardens and flowers and lawns out here in the front of this place? Do you think that's the natural state of that grass and those flowers? Of course not. They are pretty and nice and tailored and neat because somebody is working like crazy to keep them that way. They're cutting them and they're fertilizing them and they're trimming them and they're digging around them. And if they were let to resort to their normal state, there'd be a whole bunch of weeds and cuckleburrs and big old hairy looking stuff. That's the normal state. The same is true with animals. Any animal can be tamed by providing a program to domesticate it. But if you quit doing that, they'll revert to their wild state. I am afraid. I have great fear that left alone, I would revert to my natural state. And that state is drunk, death, and destruction. Let me redefine that fear. I'm not talking about the kind of fear that I used to have. I'm not talking about the kind of I'm afraid of the dark or I'm afraid of this, that, and the other. I'm talking about a fear that is referenced in that other big book when it says a fear of God. What it means is a reverent respect. I have a reverent respect for the disease of alcoholism. In the pamphlet on the 12 traditions illustrated, about the third page over, about the middle of the page, there's a little comment by Bill reprinted from somewhere else that says we have two higher powers. Have any of y'all seen that? It says we have a higher power called God and we have a higher power called John Barleycorn. I reference that to the bad higher power. And that bad higher power is sitting there saying, if you don't let God help you, I'm going to get you. And that's the way it is with me. If I don't let you and the spiritual strength of this program help me, if I don't let you help me, then John Barleycorn will strike me down and I'll revert to my natural state, which is not pleasant and not fun. I was dismissed from the University of Alabama and the judge asked me not to come back to Tuscaloosa. And I didn't. Things turn so many full circles in this beautiful program. I didn't go back to Tuscaloosa for exactly 11 years. And when I did, I went back to do what I'm doing right now. I went back to speak at the Tuscaloosa AA group. And I went in after dark and left before daylight. I don't know what the statute of limitations on aggravated grand theft catfish is, you know, but I wasn't gonna find out. Let me make an announcement now. I need to make an announcement. The announcement's this, and this is one of those. Have you ever been to a meeting and maybe you were right because you heard what the speaker was saying? There was communication, there was fellowship, there was something going on. I was sitting in a group half this big one night, and a guy named Elmore C. Bless his heart. Elmore's got Alzheimer's and doesn't even know where he is, but he's sober. And Elmore was speaking that night, and Elmore made this announcement, and it stayed with me forever and ever. And I share it with you. Quote, "No one in this room," now by the way, this includes Al-Anon's, Alateen's, special guests, and any hotel staff that might be peeking in. "Nobody in this room ever has to take another drink unless they want to." Nobody in this room ever has to take another drink unless they want to. That was big news to me. There were lots of times in my life where I did not know that I had that option, one day at a time or otherwise. The second part of that announcement is that nobody in this room has to go any lower to the disease of alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. That means it always gets worse and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. Nobody ever has to go any lower than you are right now. If you're here tonight and you're sober, or if you're here tonight and you're not sober, you don't have to go any lower down to a lower bottom than where you are right now. You can take this beautiful conference in this room tonight if you are so inclined, and it can be the bottom for you. It can be the gateway in the path to reaching a new happiness and a new joy that you can only find with the promises. Well, I have to say that then because I started getting sick, and my life became a total path of the desolation of active alcoholism from that point on. I joined the service and I was court-martialed and I was ordered into treatment and I mortified my family. Can you imagine a career full colonel who wanted his son to go to West Point and he ends up with a drunken private who keeps getting court-martialed? I began to have no self-concept. I didn't have a good one anyway. Still don't, really. But I'm working on it. But I began to have no self-esteem. I began to have no self-concept. I didn't like me at all because me wasn't my kind of person. I knew that. Me was not my kind of person. My kind of person was something else. The only way I could survive was to fantasize and be something that I wasn't. To be way out there, to live another life, to live your life, to be something else for you, because if you saw the real me, you wouldn't like me. And I desperately wanted you to like me. Desperately. Desperately. I got out of the service and I got a job with a large corporate structure. I got a pretty wife. I got two kids. I got a 3-bedroom brick. I got a pocket full of credit cards. Took a shot at being a deacon in the Baptist church. I had everything that a person could want, but I had something else, and that was a disease called alcoholism. Cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. That means it always gets worse and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. And I didn't do anything about it because I didn't know I had it. Life was really bad. Family life was bad. Job life got bad. Spiritual life went away. You know, we know what alcoholism is because the big book tells us what it is. It is a tripart disease. It affects you physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And it affected me in the reverse of that order because my spiritual life was wiped out to begin with. It's almost a simple decision. If you drink enough on Saturday night and your hangovers are bad enough on Sunday morning, then you've got to either quit drinking so much on Saturday night or quit going to church and Sunday school on Sunday morning. And it's only logical to quit going to church and Sunday school. And then I would sit there on Sunday morning and I would be so afraid and so alone. You talk about alone. Nobody can be as alone as a suffering alcoholic. Johnny Cash sang a song one time and it had a line in it entitled "Lonesome to the Bone." And boy, could I identify with that. Because I'd sit there on Sunday morning, all the radio stations playing gospel music, all the TV stations doing church services, and I'm sitting there trying to sip on some beer and get well enough to come back to life. And everything that I held dear was out there. And I was in here all alone with me. And boy, I'm not good company. My life got real bad. I was very obstructive and very abusive and very all of those sort of things. And I share this one little thing with you, and then I don't even think I'll share that with you because the time's fleeting. But I was court committed to the insane asylum, and I should have been. And I was run off to a regular old insane asylum, and I should have been. And I got out of there and left. I escaped and fled to Alabama, and then everything was complicated, and I had to go back and surrender and be properly discharged. And it was bad. It was a mess. It was complicated, and lawyers and judges and doctors and court hearings, and I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and could not stand life. I moved to Alabama and conned my poor little family into coming with me, and we had no communication, of course, because you can't communicate with such as I. And they were trying, and we know, what does it tell us in chapter 9 about the middle of the first page? Years of living with any alcoholic is sure to make any wife and children ill to some degree. And certainly, that was us. And we moved to Alabama, and drinking got bad, and life got bad. I hit that point in life where I was teaching school, and even my first cousin and my sister had to fire me. Because I was just such a mess that my first cousin, the superintendent of education, and my sister, my boss, had to finally say, "Tom, we just can't renew your contract. You are just a disgrace to everything." I reached that point where I was too embarrassed to even walk down in our little town to get the mail. I would only go out at night, like some of those creatures in some of these movies. I would creep out at night to a bootlegger to get some more elixir to live. And I was dying inside, and my physical health was shot, my spiritual life was gone, my financial and family life was totally bankrupt. The only flicker, the only fleeting hope came from two sources. One source was the unceasing prayers of a mother and some people that still love me, and prayers are answered. And the other was Al-Anon. My wife was going to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon was helping her. But Al-Anon wasn't working Al-Anon's program because they wasn't supposed to, but they were helping me too. Because Al-Anons became my enablers. On several occasions, Al-Anons, not AAs, Al-Anons bailed me out or picked me up or hauled me off or took me to a hospital. And Al-Anon saved my life. The last time I went to a hospital, and I went to HEAP. There were no treatment programs as we know them now. It was go shake and sweat and hallucinate and hurt and tremors and whatever else, and maybe a little bit of paraldehyde or some Thorazine or something, but no treatment. Just dry them out, get out again and drink again. And then I got in with the mental healthies, and they started helping me to regain my mental health by treating my alcoholism as a Valium and Thorazine deficiency. And then I got sick. I reached that point in life where I was 100% completely, totally, absolutely miserable when I was drinking, and I was 100% totally, completely, absolutely miserable when I wasn't drinking. And that left me one place to go, and that was passed out. There's a big problem with passed out. It's called come to. Many was the time I had no intention of coming to. Can you imagine a person going into a darkened bedroom with a half-gallon bottle of I.W. Harper with no cap on it and no intention to come out, and somebody picking the door, breaking the lock, and hauling me off 2 or 3 days later. I was taken to a new hospital, not far from here. I was taken by some Al-Anons on a holiday to Macon County Hospital over in Tuskegee, Alabama, and I love to share this with an audience like you because you can understand. And you can understand both the motive and the intent of why I share it just like I do. I was in and out of that little hospital for three or four times this coming Christmas season 15 years ago. I ran into a new kind of doctor, a recovered or recovering alcoholic doctor. He didn't believe in all the pills. He believed in shaking and sweating and appreciating your sobriety a little bit. And I'd go AMA and I'd run and I'd come back, and it was miserable. I was in there on and off and on and off and off and on. But let me share with you the last time. I share this with you because I believe the essence of our spiritual program is sharing. And I know that if you will hang on to this, that it'll help you. And then by keeping your own positive charge and spiritual strength, that when I need you, you'll have it to give it back to me. Give it back to me multiplied, shaken down, and running over. Share this with me. The third day of that third hospitalization, I lay in that bed in that hospital, sick, shaking, despondent. No job, hadn't had one for several months. I was white collar unemployable. I had no money. I had bounced checks everywhere. I didn't know what I'd shot holes into. One car was being repossessed. The other one was wrecked. Behind on my payments. Had no self-respect, no concept of anything, no God, no hope, no love. And my dad came to visit me. And he looked down at me in that bed. And he said, "I've got some bad news for you." You know, I heard somebody snicker, and I did too. I said, "Boy, this is, you know, how can you... Go ahead and kill me. You know, kill me. I deserve to die." And he said that my wife had taken the children and gone home to Oklahoma and probably wouldn't be back. And I have to be honest, and I can't say that my wife leaving was that big a deal, because I was basically incapable of love and had destroyed any real relationship with that lady. But I love my children. Oh, do I love my children. And I could see the pain in my dad's eyes, because he knew that he was losing, too, his grandson, T3, Thomas III, named after him, the great joy in the latter part of that man's life. And he knew that that grandson, that joy to his golden years, was being taken away. And his pain was great, and I could feel his pain. And that touched something in me. And he said, "You know, I had no need for the mobile home you were buying, and you were way behind on the payments, so we called the finance company and they picked it up. When I lost my home, I literally lost it. There was nothing there but a pile of concrete blocks, a power pole, some kerosene drums, a bunch of broken little toys, some dust. Your things are in the garage, son." And he kind of shake his head, and Dad came up with his own variety of tough love. He got it out of a different big book, but nonetheless the same thing. The book of James speaks of it too. He said, "Son, I love you because you're my son, but I don't like you." And I didn't like me. And he left. I followed him to the door. I was ambulatory, you know. Share this with me. Share this with me. And I stood at the door at the Macon County Hospital, looking down at the lake that is the water supply for Tuskegee. And I stood there looking at that lake, and deep within whatever spark of humanity was left in me, with a fully operative altruistic motivation. And that's the kind of thing that lets alcoholics kill themselves very effectively. Not while they're drunk, but about the third day. That's when they leave hospitals. That's when they escape from insane asylums. That's when they hang themselves and put guns in their mouth. And I stood there on that totally despondent, looking at that lake, and well down with inside me, I resolved just to run down and drown myself in that lake to get the burden that I was. See these millstones around here? To get the burden, the millstone that I was, out from around the necks of the few people that I thought still cared for me. My daughter, my sister, my mother, and one sweet little old lady at the Hainville Baptist Church, deacon's wife, that had prayed unceasingly. And so I was going to do that. Now, I have heard all my life, and you may have heard, that God helps those who help themselves. I don't believe that's true at all. I believe, in fact, just the exact opposite. I believe that the New Testament and the big book, where, like it says, came to believe that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Friends, self is the biggest human power of all. Self, the thing we got to get out of the way. I believe that God helps those who admit they are helpless. And I stood there at that door, and I, unknowingly to myself, almost just cried out like so many drunks have, from Bill and on. and on. 50 years. God help me. And when you do that, He does. It says so, that God could and would, can and will. If sought, I sought. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, I knocked. Open. And I said, you know, God help me. In a feeling, not a voice, not a hallucination, not a anything, not a great white flash, just a feeling, said, before you do this, Tom, not don't do it, but just before you do it, touch base with a Baptist preacher. And I went to the phone book, and I looked in the phone book, and there were two Baptist churches in that little community in those days, and I knew one of them was the white Baptist church and one of them was the black Baptist church, and I was darned if I'd call the black Baptist preacher by mistake to save my soul before I committed suicide. And I was too proud and too vain and too full of false garbage to go ask the black attendants which one was which. And I stood at that door, suicidal, insane, despondent, going crazy, alcoholic. And I stood back and opened the door for a man to come in. And he walked down the hall, around the corner, and gone. And a little old black lady sitting right over there minding her own business all the time I was going crazy looked me right dead in the eye and said, "Isn't that Reverend Butler, the Baptist minister?" I said, "I don't know, lady, but I'm going to find out." And I followed him down the hall, and indeed it was. It was Reverend Butler. Not only that, in those days, not all ministers were all that fond or knowledgeable about our program and alcoholism, but this one was. This one was. Went to open meetings, sent people to Al-Anon, got involved. This one was. And we prayed together, and something went away. And before Reverend Butler went away, here came that crazy recovering alcoholic doctor named Carl. Carl came in and said he'd just riding around, thought he'd stop by and see me. It wasn't his time of day to come in. And we shared, and something went away. And before he went away, here came George and Clara B. from the Tuskegee AA group. Said they'd just riding around, thought they might want to come by and visit with me and see how I was doing. And we shared together, and something went away. And before they went away, the phone rang, and it was Buddy, then 28-year-old recovering alcoholic in the Tuskegee group, that called to say he wanted to check me out that night and take me over to a meeting in Opelika. And he did, and I went. And when I got back, I never, never, never went back into the total, utter depth of desperation and gloom that late-stage terminal alcoholism. All five of those people are dead today. They were dead within 2 years of that incident. Reverend Baker died within 7 months. George had a stroke. Clara couldn't stand the pain of arthritis and took her own life. Dr. Carl never really got sober and ultimately died of complications of open heart surgery, and Buddy died drunk at age 30. But all five of those people were there when God wanted them there for me, just as they will be there when you call out in utter desperation, and just as you can share in this fellowship of love. Well, I've told you a lot about how it is now. It's good, but it hurts. It hurts because I too have not remembered some of the basic truths of this program. And during the course of the last 2 or 3 years, for a lot of things that I'm probably ultimately responsible for, I allowed a marriage of 20 years to go down the tube, and recently had to go through the great pain of dividing a family. We divided fairly peacefully because we're both trying to work our program, but it hurts. It's hard. A piece of me is not here. And I need you. I need you to share me. I need you to pet on me. I need you to say, "Hey, it's all right. You know, you can stay sober. And if you're sober, you can do it a day at a time. You can rebuild. You can regrow. You can look forward." And that's what I'm doing tonight. I'm looking out at the beauty of life. And that's you. You see, we talk about the pretty sunsets and the grass and smell the flowers and look at the birds and the bees, but you are the beauty of God's creation, each and every one of you. You are the only thing that is totally unique. You are the most valuable commodity that God has ever created. And certainly I need to remember that I am one of those too. God don't create no trash. And He made me in His own image. Big time got me. He was in his 16th year of sobriety when he got me. And you know, the 16th year of sobriety is a very dangerous year. Y'all know that, don't you? And he needed to go to lots of meetings all over central Alabama. And he asked me to take him. And do you know I got that old reprobate through that dangerous 16th year cold sober? I sure did. And at the end of that dangerous 16th year, he gave me this silver dollar right here. Because without anything of mine, but taking the gift of love and grace that you gave me, I had not found it necessary to take a drink that year. And things began to get a little bit better, and life began to get a little bit better. You see, I stood at the turning point in that hospital. I asked his protection and care with complete abandon. And we know the steps that I took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I pray each morning that I might continue that program of recovery. One day at a time became the key. You know, I was too fancy for that until it dawned on me that every great religion and every great philosophy that the world has ever known. Confucius said the longest journey begins with a single step. Aristotle and Plato talked about it. When God took care of the children of Israel when they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, how did he do it? One day at a time. Gave them that manna from heaven. One day at a time. When the Master walked the rocky shores of the Sea of Galilee and gathered the people together in that big eating meeting they call the Sermon on the Mount, which was also part of the very foundation of this program, he shared with them in Matthew 6:34, if you dig the foreign language of King James, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. A modern paraphrase, we'll call that, live one day at a time. When we join hands in 3 or 4 minutes and close this beautiful meeting, we'll run past the line, boom, when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we'll run past the line that says, give us this day our daily bread. Give us this day. Not a month's supply, not, you know, a year's warehouse. Give us this day our daily bread. Let me close by sharing something for you to take home from Columbus, Georgia. You know, everything out there in the world doesn't love us. They don't understand our disease. They don't understand our family illness. They don't understand all this business about children of alcoholics and codependents and all these things that are in the big book and been there since 1939. They don't know that alcoholism is what it is. They don't know that we do what we do. They don't know we are what we are. You know, it's up to us to take them that message. And I'd like for you to take this home with you. It's something that is meaningful to me, because when the Master walked the rocky shores of the Sea of Galilee and gathered the people together and taught them, there were people who didn't believe him. There were people who took cheap shots at him. There were people who wanted to check his bona fides, his credentials, and how was he, what university did he go to, and where did he get his clinical training, the great physician that he was. He had a friend. A guy was chairman of another group, in fact, John. It was John's group, John the Baptist. John had another group over on the other side of the valley there, and John found himself incarcerated when this story took place. You can check it out. And a situation, by the way, incarcerated, not unknown to some of the people in this room, I suspect, certainly me. But John was locked up, and he worried about the master counselor over there, and that's what the book said that he would be, you know. It said that he shall be called Wonderful Counselor. Counselors are people who share. Counselors are people who share with people who hurt. The great physician. John didn't know about the Master, so he got a couple people on his steering committee. He said, come here, guys. He said, the Master Counselor is having his eating meeting over there on the side of the Mount of Olives. Go over there and ask him if he is the one who is to come that Isaiah and the prophets talked about, or if there is another one. In other words, check him out. See if he's real. See if he's doing his thing. See if he is the real thing. And they said, okay, John. And they went on over there, and the Master finished up the meeting, and everybody was, shaking hands and all like they do after the meeting. And they walked up and they said, hey, John sent us, and we want to ask you something. Are you he who is to come, or is there another? The Master Counselor did what I would suggest you do when people take cheap shots at AA and don't understand us and criticize. He didn't talk about methodology. He didn't talk about theology. He didn't talk about doctrine. He didn't talk about philosophy. The master counselor spoke in the absolutely time-tested and fire crucible of truth of results. The master counselor spoke of results. He said, go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. Go and tell John what you've seen and what you have heard. The blind see, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the sick are made well, the lepers are cleansed. Go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. When people criticize, when people don't understand, those of you who might be new, if you need something to put some power in your battery, if you need a joy and a truth, ask those who doubt to come to an open AA meeting. Ask those who question to come to a public information meeting. Ask them to attend an Al-Anon family group meeting. Bring them into the midst of what we have right here in this room, and you take it home with you too, and you look around, and then go and tell what you have seen and what you have heard. Jobs are preserved, families are maintained, self-respect is returned, love is abundant, the drugged are clean, and the drunk are sober. Go and tell what you have seen and what you have heard. I believe that all of that and all of this and what we are and where we're going is the result of another great promise that the Master made when he walked the rocky shores of Sea of Galilee. He said, and he promised, I have come that ye might have life and have it more abundantly. In Columbus, Georgia, year of our Lord, 1985, state conference, I give you life and life more abundantly. And I love you.
Thank you, Tom, for sharing your strength, experience, and hope with us. And if you will, remain standing and let's join hands and repeat together the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back.